Well, what a wonderful spring morning. Good morning to you. Thanks for coming out this morning, taking time away from the natural beauty to visit the sattvic beauty of this chapel. Hard to say on a morning like this which will be the more beneficial to you, but the Japanese call a walk in the woods on a day like this forest bathing. Forest bathing. Purifying ourselves in that way. So we're chapel bathing this morning. We're chapel bathing. Of course, we have announcements. These are in reverse chronological order this morning, from the most distant to the nearer. Mark your calendar for a weekend retreat at the end of April. Swami Nirakaranandaji of the St. Louis Center will be here from Friday evening, April 26th, until Sunday morning on the 28th, offering his wisdom on Raja Yoga. I should note that the Swami is a surpassingly good singer and instrumentalist. He favors the harmonium, but he plays other instruments as well. I don't know whether he will on that particular Saturday, but his Saturday workshop will be based around music. He will sing us songs and then explain their significance. And then, of course, he'll deliver the Sunday morning talk on the 28th of April.
St. Louis.
He's an assistant minister there to Swami Chetanananda. Swami Nirakaranandaji is Argentine by birth, and so he speaks fluent Spanish and is able to offer Spanish classes in Spanish as well as English. And he sings songs in Spanish so beautifully. Because we always like to get the place ready for these visiting Swamis, Seva Saturday for April will fall on the 14th. It's not an unusual that it will fall on the 14th. Please note that date. It's the second Saturday of the month, as usual. Please join us for some period between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. If you're here at lunchtime, there will be a delicious lunch served. This is a fine way to show your dedication to the center and its success. So please do join us. It is a joyous occasion working with the other devotees, and it produces wonderful results for the center. And now, as I said, in reverse chronological order, next Sunday's talk demonstrates the great saying, truth is one. Sages call it by many names. We will discuss the principles of the Baal Shem Tov, an 18th century Jewish saint, very like in his behavior to Saint Francis of Assisi, and perhaps those of you who know the saints, the many saints of India, will recognize similar characteristics there also. He conversed with the animals and the birds and the trees, and saw the divine presence everywhere. The principles of the Baal Shem Tov. Purim is a Jewish holiday that fell on this weekend, but I elected to wait and talk about the Jewish aspect until next weekend at the end of the month. So we'll talk about the Baal Shem Tov next week. Are there any other announcements that I should have made that I failed to make? Okay, thank you. We'll begin with our opening chant, which reminds us of our purpose here and helps us recollect our relationship to the divine being. This is a translation by our beloved Swami Yogeshananda. For those of you who care about him, he continues to persist. He continues to live in Tribhuco, though his health is failing. He just wrote me an email saying that he now has skin cancer, and so doesn't expect to live that much longer. So this is our beloved Swami Yogeshananda's translation of this ancient prayer. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Vunaktu, Saha Viryang Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navaditamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. What a lovely invitation to study the art of spirituality together. So once again, welcome. March is a month for the study of Karma Yoga, a spiritual path leading to the abandonment of selfishness. As a Karma Yogi, you practice offering your actions and their results, as well as your perceptions, thoughts, and feelings to the Divine Presence. Even before fully knowing this presence, you hold firmly to the belief that that presence is within each person or other living being that you interact with or serve. Working and abiding in this spirit, you are increasingly able to release attachment to your activities and their results. This yields the freedom and contentment promised by Karma Yoga. In Chapter 2 of the Gita, Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, even a little practice of this yoga will save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. Even a little practice of Karma Yoga will save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. That's what we've been exploring this month. What does it mean to practice just a little? We'll elaborate some of that this morning as well. The title of this morning's talk, Metaphors Be With Us. Metaphors Be With Us. Of course, it's a pun on that phrase from the Star Wars movies, may the Force be with us. This particular Metaphors Be With Us was a turn of phrase by my dear friend Peter Schneider, Hiranyagarbha, who left us way too young back in Los Angeles. Metaphors be with us. Last Sunday, many of us celebrated St. Patrick's Day. Ireland's patron saint inspired observances from silly to the sublime wherever we looked. St. Patrick used the shamrock, Ireland's national symbol, as a potent metaphor for the Christian Holy Trinity. Even if your heritage is not Irish, you may have felt a wee tug at your heart when you saw that three-leaf clover offered in ceremonial joy. It seems natural, then, to explore the idea of metaphor and how it affects the way we think, act, and progress in our spiritual lives. As we know, our great spiritual teachers have often introduced us to life-transforming truths by telling what appear to be simple, allegorical stories and parables. In today's talk, we will explore and discuss metaphorical instruction left us by five teachers who are at the heart of our spiritual tradition: the sage Vasishta, Sri Krishna, Jesus Christ, Patanjali, and Sri Ramakrishna. Just so we're clear what we mean, this is a definition of metaphor from the website Literary Devices, Definition and Examples of Literary Terms. Quote, When you portray a person, place, or thing as an action, when you portray a person, place, thing, or action as being something else, even though it is not actually that something else, you are speaking metaphorically. For example, he is the black sheep of the family is a metaphor because that person is not a sheep and is not even black. However, we can use this comparison to describe an association of a black sheep with that person. A black sheep is known to be an unusual animal that typically strays away from the herd, and the person you are describing shares those similar characteristics. So, describing one thing in terms of another. Metaphors be with us, may the force be with us. Of course, in that phrase, the force is a metaphor for the power of the divine presence. Use the force, Luke. Use the force, Luke, Obi-Wan Kenobi said. And he was able, Luke Skywalker, in those movies, was able to learn to get his small s self out of the way and allow the force to guide his actions. We'll hear about that in some detail. But starting in our exploration of spiritual metaphors with the sage Vasishtha, he uses the word illusion as a metaphor. This is from the Nectar of Supreme Knowledge, Shloka 23. Vasishtha said to Rama, "In reality, nothing ever originates anywhere or is destroyed. Brahman alone exists in the form of the world illusion." The world illusion. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just exists in a temporary, overlaid form. The technical term in our tradition is Saguna Brahman, Brahman with attributes. But the attributes made of the gunas and appearing to us as time, space, and causation, which are themselves metaphors, these things are what attract our attention and therefore distract us, pull our attention away from the reality. And so Vasishtha says to Rama, in reality, nothing ever originates anywhere or is destroyed. Brahman alone eternally exists in the form of the world illusion, Saguna Brahman. Sri Krishna, from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, the Yoga of Mysticism. And for those of you who are learning the language that is spoken here, Maya is a Sanskrit word for the world illusion that Vasishtha spoke of. Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, Maya makes all things. Maya, the world illusion, makes all things. What moves, what is unmoving. That is why the world spins, turning its wheel through birth and through destruction. Fools pass blindly by the place of my dwelling here in the human form, which Sri Krishna's human form is itself a metaphor for his divine presence. Fools pass blindly by the place of my dwelling here in the human form, and of my majesty they know nothing at all, who am the Lord, the soul. Vain is their hope, and vain their labor, their knowledge. All their understanding is but bewilderment. the nature has, their nature has fallen into the madness of the fiends and monsters. In the language that we know of Sanskrit, these fiends and monsters are asuras and daityas. Again, metaphors for what these human beings have become. But is this an irredeemable situation? Now, Krishna says they have lost their way by the hypnosis of the world illusion. Maya makes all things. And so our hypnotism with all of these made things leads us to fall into the madness of the asuras and daityas. And all we have to do is look around at the society that we're living in, and we see how immersed we are in this. But is this an irredeemable situation? No. Sri Krishna says, yet though a man be soiled with the sins of a lifetime, let him but love me. Though a man be soiled with the sins of a lifetime, let him but love me, rightly resolved, in utter devotion. I see no sinner. That man is holy. Holiness soon shall transform his nature to peace eternal. Holiness soon shall refashion his nature to peace eternal. O son of Kunti, of this be certain. The man that loves me, he shall not perish. Now, this statement is just full of metaphor. Sin. Sin is a metaphorical word for what? For our actions based in ignorance and misunderstanding. So, I see no sinner. Oh, before that, devotion. Devotion is a metaphorical word that gestures toward that deep feeling of reverence that comes to us when we have focused on our relationship with the divine, which is here, not there. Focused on our devotion. So devotion is a metaphor for that relationship, that feeling of relationship. That man is holy. Holy is also a metaphorical word. Metaphorical means, it's holy means that the person has been purified. Purified of their ignorance. A natural phenomenon, as Sri Krishna describes it. Holiness soon shall refashion his nature to peace eternal. Peace eternal is, again, metaphorical speech for becoming one with the divine presence. It's the same thing that Jesus was speaking of when he said, the peace that passeth all understanding. O son of Kunti, by this he means, O son, one born of woman. One born of woman, O son of Kunti, of this be certain, the man that loves me, he shall not perish. Perhaps one of the most potent metaphorical stories, parables, they're called, when the metaphor is extended into the fullness of a story, it's called a parable. This is from Jesus Christ. It's told in the book of Luke, chapter 15. And it's the parable of the prodigal son. Now, this is precisely the same message, just in fleshed out, that Krishna just delivered when he said, Love me, rightly resolved in utter devotion, I see no sinner. So listen to Jesus tell this story. And Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And the father divided his property between them, his two sons. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. And as he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, this is how hungry he was. You know, the pods, the empty shells of the, from which the peas had been taken, from which the beans had been taken, these are fed to the pigs. He hungered, he was so hungry, he longed to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, yet no one gave him anything. No one loves you when you're down and out. But when he came to himself, he said, how many? But when he came to himself, now notice the turn in the story. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. This is the Jewish way of saying, I have utterly abandoned righteousness. I have sinned before heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. This becomes his resolve. Notice the sense of reality and humility here. He sees that his father's servants are better off than him. And he recognizes that he has abandoned righteousness and so is no longer worthy to be called the man's son, but he does ask to be taken as one of his servants. As we all know, one of the primary relationships that we can have with the divine presence is that of servant. But then notice what happens. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called to one of the servants and asked, what do these things mean? And the servant said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he has received him back safe and sound. The older brother was angry and refused to join the celebration. His father came out and entreated with him. But he answered his father, look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command, and yet you never gave me even a young goat that I may celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes. You killed the fattened calf for him. Notice the accusation, the judgment. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. And his father said to him, Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. So notice two things. First, when the son turned in humility to his father, this is how he was received. The son who was an errant miscreant, a true sinner. But what does the father answer to the son who objects, who judges? He said, Son, you were always with me. All that is mine is yours. So both sons were equally valued. For those of us who don't stray off in this miscreant way, let's remind ourselves of this part of the parable. Because Jesus amplified this in later remarks and said, you have only to ask, and it will be given. You have only to knock, and it shall be opened unto you. If you ask for bread, will your father give you a stone? If you ask for bread, will your father give you a stone? If you ask for a fish, will you be given a serpent? So those of us who remain faithful and do not disobey, remember the treasure is fully and always ours. Does anyone have a cough drop to give to this lady? So this is a parable, an extended metaphor. And if you want to know, does this really happen? All you have to do is study the life of Girish Ghosh. Girish Ghosh was a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna who was an absolute reprobate, a debauchee. There was nothing in the way of sin that he didn't engage in. And yet, through his recognition of who Sri Ramakrishna is, he became a saint. Holiness did, in fact, refashion his nature to sainthood. So these are these powerful stories. Mahatma Gandhi said of Sri Ramakrishna, he said, if you wish to understand the Vedas, study the life of Sri Ramakrishna. He lived them. And if you study particularly the Gyanakanda of the Vedas, the Upanishads, if you study them, you will see that Sri Ramakrishna did, in fact, Gandhi was remarking on the fact that Sri Ramakrishna did, in fact, embody the principles and practices that are talked about in the Vedas and the Upanishads, for that matter, in the Vedas. So how does this, when we're refashioned, how does this actually work? And here's something from Patanjali. This is from Swami Prabhupada's How to Know God, his translation of and commentary on Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. This is Chapter 1, Sutra 18, and it regards seeds and burnt seeds. The other kind of concentration is that in which consciousness contains no object. If we practice concentration on a mantra, that's an object. If we can't practice concentration on a picture, that's an object. If we practice concentration on a visualization inside us, that's an object. So that's one kind of concentration. The other kind of concentration is that in which consciousness contains no object, only subconscious impressions, which are like burnt seeds. The subconscious impressions, Sanskrit is samskaras or vasanas. They come, if we believe in the premise of reincarnation, these impressions come from the time when that is which is now manifest as us, as a human being, was at the very beginning stages of life, a one-celled creature. All of these impressions stay with us, we're told. But when we practice concentration, and these impressions come up and try to intrude on our concentration and meditation, we do not give them our attention, and so we rob them of their power. And ultimately, when the truth that is behind the screen of Maya, when the truth emerges, and the power of that truth is far greater than, as Mother said, the divine name is more powerful than the senses. So when that truth, that power emerges, it, so to speak, burns these seeds. They are fried in the oil of your knowledge. And so they become no longer able to germinate, that is, produce further action, further karmas. So this is very profound what he's saying. And the technique is, as described by Patanjali, it is attained by constantly checking the thought waves through the practice of non-attachment. And that's just what I roughly described to you. These thought waves arise, these thought waves based on these ancient and even very current mental impressions. When we don't give them our attention, when we detach ourselves from them, this state of burnt seeds is attained by constantly checking the thought waves, not allowing the thought waves to go to those old impressions, through the practice of non-attachment. And so when what you are in the presence of, and in a spiritual sense attached to, this divine presence, this knowledge of the divine presence, it renders those old thought waves, those old thought forms, ineffective. And so Patanjali uses the metaphor of burnt seeds. They become like burnt seeds. And it takes years of practice. Now, Sri Ramakrishna used many, many metaphors in his teachings. He spoke as a village person. He was a village Brahmin from West Bengal. His language was not polished. His metaphors were simple and humble and, so to speak, country-based, but very, very profound. Sri Ramakrishna said, "Whatever is done here," pointing to himself, "whatever is done here is done for you all. Ah, if I do all 16 parts, the whole, you may possibly do one." And of course, the metaphor of 16 parts is from the 16 anas that make up a rupee, the Indian coin. In those days, one rupee was very valuable, and so 1/16 was also valuable. But what he uses the metaphor of the rupees and the anas, saying, "I have done it all. All that is required of you is that you do one." I'll read it again. "Whatever is done here is done for you all. Ah, if I do all the 16 parts, you may possibly do one." This is from The Great Master by Swami Sarvananda. So we've come back full circle to the idea of world illusion. What is done here, if any action, is necessarily part of the duality, is part of the illusion, is part of Maya. So this is from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, chapter 36, The Master's Birthday, Sunday, February 22nd, 1885. Sri Ramakrishna said, "Water is water, whether it is still or in waves." Now, as we all know, that we've read Sri Ramakrishna's teachings, he used water as a metaphor for consciousness, pure consciousness. The ocean of consciousness. Water is water, whether it is still, Brahman, or in waves, Saguna Brahman, or Maya. Water still, Nirguna Brahman. Water in waves. An amplification of what was said by Vasishtha earlier. Vasishtha said to Rama, "This illusion that you experience is nothing more than a vibration of consciousness." Consciousness in waves. So Sri Ramakrishna is pointing directly back to that thinking. Water is water, whether it is still or in waves. Let me tell you something else. Go beyond knowledge and ignorance, the waves. Go beyond knowledge and ignorance. Vasishtha was a great Jnani, but even he was stricken with grief on account of the death of his sons. At this, Lakshmana said to Rama, "This is amazing, Rama. Even Vasishtha is so grief-stricken." Rama said, "Brother, he who has knowledge has ignorance as well. He who is aware of light is also aware of darkness. He who knows good also knows bad. He who knows happiness also knows misery. Brother, go beyond duality, beyond pleasure and pain, beyond knowledge and ignorance." So we're told to go beyond the metaphor. The metaphor is the gesture in the direction of wisdom, not knowledge, wisdom. We all, from moment to moment, are living the world illusion. We live immersed in duality. There's no way out of it. As long as we have the sense that I am this and that is that, in any way, even in the depths of meditation, I am experiencing this meditative state, this bliss, this sat, this chit. Now, Patanjali says that if you attain that state, then something happens to you. The first six limbs of yoga, he says, are self-effort, purushakar. The seventh and eighth are samadhi and kaivalya. They are something that happens to you. But we cannot attain, well, it's not true that we cannot. Perhaps those of us who have done enough work in past lifetimes, we don't have to do the first six limbs before the seventh and eighth will happen to us. Swami Prabhavananda was asked about that and said, yes, yes, it happens. It's very rare, but it happens. But for most of us, we have to do this business of karma yoga. We have to begin to believe what Sri Krishna says, that it's Maya doing all this, that you are not the doer. So to begin to practice just a little this karma yoga, begin to offer everything to me. When you wake up in the morning, offer the day to me. When you go to the bathroom, offer that to me. He mentions that specifically. When you eat, offer that to me. When you sleep, offer that to me. Slowly and slowly, this is the practice of non-attachment. This is the practice of non-attachment. It's not mine, it's yours. And that which I experience is the gift that I have received from you. All of life becomes prasad. So this is, if we understand that what we're experiencing moment to moment, this moment, every moment that we are experiencing, it is a metaphor for the truth of our being. A metaphor gestures towards something that represents something else. The world illusion is a gesture toward that something else. This is Saguna Brahman. The something else is Nirguna Brahman, the water that is still or in waves. And so this is the practice of karma yoga that underlies this talk this morning. This understanding that though it doesn't seem to me at this moment to be so, Sri Krishna, Sri Ramakrishna, for that matter, Jesus Christ, all tell us, you're not doing this. It's not in the canonical Gospels very specifically, but it is in the others. It's in the Gospel of the Beloved Companion and in the Gospel of Thomas. Jesus is saying that you're not doing this. I'm doing this. I am this. And if you drink from my mouth, I will become you. Just as Krishna says, you become very dear to me, I will become you. Whatever is doing that, could you please stop it, make it stop? So this has gotten kind of heavy. Because this is solemn stuff. Let's lighten it up. If you're going to have a conversation, please take it in the other room. If you're going to talk on the phone, please take it in the other room. So now, what has this given rise to in you? What questions, what comments do you have? This is what's meant by studying the art of spirituality together. What about this is significant to you? Let's lighten the moment from...
Well, I guess I have a question.
Yes,
dear. I'm not sure I caught everything that you said, but you said that, I think you said, because I was drifting off a little bit, when I dragged myself back, I only got most of what you said. I think you said everything we experience is a metaphor. So would that metaphor be a metaphor of what... Of your experiences, or
all of our experiences are a metaphor for what is behind it. The person that is called a black sheep isn't really a black sheep, but it has the characteristics. That person has the characteristics of a black sheep. As we experience the world illusion, we don't see it clearly because of our distraction, but it has the characteristics of Brahman.
Okay, a metaphor for Brahman.
It's a metaphor for Brahman, yes. Yes?
I see that Ramakrishna used the metaphors. His metaphors were most powerful and simple and very easy to understand because
yes.
They were from everyday life. And nobody else, including Swami Vivekananda, had that kind of metaphors, those kind of metaphors.
Yeah, it's interesting that what we have of Swami Vivekananda is mostly his teachings in the West. That's what's mostly in his 9 volumes. And he was speaking to Westerners of a particular mindset and a particular time. So people who come from India and share much of what Sri Ramakrishna had as the life stream, his life stream, they find his metaphors very easy to understand. When he talks about scum on the surface of a pond, for example, and parting the scum and seeing the pure water underneath, most Westerners have never done that. They've never been to a tank. They've never been to a... You know, they may have been to a pond and seen scum, but they've probably never separated the scum in order to lean over and take a drink of water. So Vivekananda's metaphors very, very skillfully, and we can see how skillfully, because they captured the attention of the intelligentsia, the thought leaders and the spiritual leaders of his time. But this is why, for example, Swami Prabhavananda wrote How to Know God. Because Swami Vivekananda's Raja Yoga, though very, very appropriate for 1896, and the students for whom he wrote it, though it became a bestseller to many, many others, is harder for us to understand. And so someone accused Swami Prabhavananda of insulting Swami Vivekananda, and that Swami Vivekananda was mad at him for having written How to Know God. Well, what did Swami Prabhavananda do? Did he protest? Did he say no? He ran immediately. And I mean ran. The story goes he literally ran to the shrine there in Hollywood. And he sat there in meditation until he received reassurance. And then he jumped up and ran back and fired off a message of quite heated message, saying Swami Vivekananda is quite happy with this and in no way insulted. So yes, the Vivekananda's metaphors are getting a little dated, some of them, for us. This is why we have a class on Wednesday night to talk about Swami Vivekananda's Jnana Yoga and make some sense of the metaphors there, the way of his way of speaking. I mean, we don't have carriages anymore. So when in London in 1895 or 1896, he's speaking, and he heard, but others who were listening to him did not, heard a carriage clatter by on the cobblestones outside. And so he used that as a metaphor for our ability to control our attention. A carriage just rolled by and clattered by, the horse clop, clop, clopping, and the wheels going clack, 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 clack on the cobblestones. But none of the audience, he noticed, had reacted to that. So he immediately used it as a metaphor for our ability to control our attention and then generalized that. But most of us have not experienced a carriage clattering by, so... Yes, you're absolutely right, John. Anyone else? Yes, Dr. Munch.
If you go to the word metaphor, meta is from one medium to the other, and four is to carry, Latinized. So basically, it is the transformative process of thinking which picks up one physical fact and interprets, piercing through the core of the heart. And although you brought up the five people who are very well known to give us the whole truth, there are many more than that, and I think Westerners are not lagging behind either. So I'm giving two more examples. One is about the author of The Tuesdays with Maury. He is a Harvard professor. But in the last part, he goes through an incurable neurological disease. So he has got to be taken care of. His disciple comes to take care of him every Tuesday. And every Tuesday, he gives one lesson, which makes it Tuesdays with Maury, which I think is a classical Vedantic textbook, in my opinion.
For those of you who didn't understand what Dr. Mudge is speaking about, the book is called Tuesdays with Maury, and you find it online. It's a beautiful, beautiful book.
So he gives the example, and I think it is very, very typically Vedantic. He says, here comes a small wave in the ocean, aspiring to be a big wave sometime, and sees that even the big wave ultimately splashes against the stones of the core and turns into water. He's very disappointed. That if this is how it is, what is the point in being a big whale? So that's where he's told. And who says you are a whale? That was water. You are water. And when you splash against that one, you turn into water, which is your natural self. This is exactly the essence, but the metaphor is Western. Same way I was thinking, that basically, Sanskrit language is known to give messages through metaphor. And there are so many of them. But some metaphors, we have to work it out with our lessons from Vedanta. For example, I was thinking, Ravana had a city called Lanka, and that was called a city of gold. So Krishna made Dwarika, which was also called city of gold. The difference was that Ravana thought he made the city. And he was carried with that illusion. And therefore he fell down. Krishna, on the other hand, thought that that was his natural duty which he did. Having done that, he has to step aside And therefore, in the last part of Krishna, when Dwarka started sinking and all the citizens, you know, they turned to drinking and so on and so forth, and he saw Dwarka being destroyed, there is no reference that Krishna was sorry that why this happened to the Dwarka, which I made, because he thought he never made it.
Well said. Okay. Well, he believed what he told others.
Exactly. That is why Krishna is called Purna Purushottama, a perfect person.
Yes.
Even Rama is not called Purna Purushottama, he is called Maryada Purushottama. He was a good man within limits. And that's why he had to go to Vasishtha over and over again. Krishna, when he was a child, he learned through Sandipani. But later on, he does not have any guru. Because he kept on teaching himself.
Mm.
And I think our Vedanta prepares us to teach ourselves, observe, change, metaphor, metamorphosis, metaphor turns into metamorphosis.
Mm. It's interesting that you said he continued to teach himself, because this is what we're told, ultimately, it's the fourth grace, the grace of our own mind, that we begin to understand because of our spiritual practices. We begin to understand not only the scriptures, but our own experiences in a very different way. Yes, Uma.
When I first read the title, Metaphors Weep for Us, I was thinking of in a literal way, you know, that we'll be talking about metaphors, similes,
mm-hmm.
and metaphors like similes, comparison to two items
mm-hmm.
which resemble each other,
mm-hmm.
but they do not necessarily do so, but mm-hmm. it suggests one suggests of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And we were taught in two ways, rupaka, rupak in Sanskrit, metaphor, and simile, comparison.
Mm-hmm.
This one is like that. For example, Nayan Kamala, that's a very famous Hindu metaphor for lotus eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Kamala Nayan, Pada Pankajam, feet like full bloom lotus.
Mm.
So this, as you think about it, then what you say, you know, really makes sense. For example, talking about illusion.
Mm-hmm.
What could be a greater example than Rajvam Bhujangama Iva? This rope which appears to be a snake, mm-hmm. our famous mm-hmm. Vedanta metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me perfectly exemplifies about one thing mistakenly taken as another, and yet it conveys by contrast the meaning that how it should be.
Not just mistaken, but misunderstood.
Yeah.
How could if you just presented someone with an acorn and said, properly nurtured, there's a giant tree in here, they wouldn't believe it if they didn't understand what an acorn was. It's a misunderstanding oftentimes.
Yes.
Of this is why we don't mistake the rope for a snake. We misunderstand what we're actually seeing.
So it's illusion.
Yes, it is. This is why Vasishtha was so accurate in his statement. And, you know, it's really worth pondering, particularly in the light of modern physics, when he says that everything we experience is nothing more than a vibration of consciousness. This is exactly what the modern physicists have concluded. Exactly. There is nothing out here, so to speak, given that there is any out here at all, that there's any division between this and that, that all that there is vibration. And these amazing Stardust spacesuits that we wear, convert that into the reality that we share. Whoa! If that isn't enough to make you reverent, what a way of being. And, you know, so we sometimes very seriously misuse the treasure that we've insisted that we be given, like the prodigal son, like the prodigal child. But what does that mean? In the long run, if we come to our senses, nothing. That was, as Swami Swahananda so often would say, what's done is done. Go forward. So anything else from anyone? This is wonderful.
Brother?
Yes, please.
There are two things which were striking me. One thing is the Maya, the power of delusion. So that is like Sri Krishna in somewhere mentions that Maya is like his own power.
Yes.
He's part of it. And the other story which you were discussing in the front, like ask, it shall be given to you, mm-hmm. the story, and if you ask for a fish, whether the serpent will be given. So most of the times when we look at the Maya, the delusion power, it is not for like, not always good, like it's always you begin tricked to that, or like you fell to that. Like even in the case of Ravana, so he was a great devotee, but he fell into Maya. So things like that. But at the same time, we tell that like ask it shall be given. So the same supreme power, like we assume it in two different ways. Like you either get tricked, or at the same time, like you ask it shall be given. How it is like? How can the same person be like so generous and gracious and taking after you, and at the same time be tricking you? So
yes. Well, you know, we have recourse to the Chandi and what it says there. In the very beginning, Brahma, addressing, so to speak, his mother, says, you are the great Devi, the great goddess, as also the great Asuri. The power, he who has knowledge also has ignorance. He who knows light also knows darkness. Maya is not made just of goodness. As Vivekananda explains absolutely, perfectly clearly in Jnana Yoga, in the book Jnana Yoga. It's not possible. It's not possible for this world illusion to exist made only of goodness. So there has to be both. And he says they're always, though we don't see it, they're always in perfect balance. So
so many examples from Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna come to my mind. Salt doll.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about that. He's so fascinating, so lovable, so silly.
So for those of you who don't know what Uma's talking about, Sri Ramakrishna talks about a salt doll, a doll made of salt, goes to measure the depth of the ocean. And you can imagine what happens as soon as he enters the ocean. And what a wonderful simile for us and our consciousness if we really, really devote ourselves to trying to measure the depth of our spirituality, we become dissolved in that spirituality. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Uma, but I was pretty sure that some of the people weren't understanding with it.
That maid who goes to clean the house of the master.
Mm-hmm.
And she does work that daily. She takes care of the children, everything. But she does not attach herself.
Mm-hmm.
To whatever she's taking care of. At that time, I think he utters one of the most profound, he gives some simile. that work like a maid, that mm-hmm. you are here, but this does not belong to you.
For those of you who don't know what Uma is talking about, Sri Ramakrishna tells this little parable. And he's describing the servant attitude, the servant bhava, the servant attitude. He says, serve like you are a village maiden who's come to the city and serves in the house of a big business person, a zamindar, as they were called. Yeah. So you're serving there, and you say, oh, this is my Rama, speaking of the child, of the senior child. This is my Rama. This is my Kamala, speaking of the female child. Isn't our house so beautiful, speaking of the house? But she knows perfectly well none of it is hers, and her heart is always in the village with her home. So this is the way, Sri Ramakrishna speaks of not only the servant attitude, but the way in the servant attitude you practice mental renunciation. Mental renunciation. Good, Uma. That's right. It's another wonderful one of the master's metaphors. As Shyam pointed out, the gospel is just full of these homely metaphors, so easy to understand. You know, the chameleon metaphor is another one. You know, all of these people arguing about what God is like. And God is like all of those things to each of those people. The chameleon's red to one person, blue to another, yellow to another. And the person who lives under the tree, you know, the sage, says, yes, the chameleon is all those colors. Beautiful. Yes, dear.
There was a sage actually who had 24 gurus, and amongst the 24 gurus, it was not just a enlightened soul who was his guru, even a crow
mm-hmm.
would take anything from nature and understand the deep metaphorical truths.
Mm-hmm.
And he considered even them his gurus, and one very stark example that he gave, very homely, was like when he was sitting in the next to an ocean, and he saw a seagull or a crow pick up a fish,
mm-hmm.
and he was flying away with it. And then he found all the other crows, or I don't know, vultures, say.
To be specific, it's a kite, a particular kind of
right. Kite. And one was this person who actually worked out for the fish. Got it out of the ocean, and these guys were chasing him. Like, he turned right, they would turn right. He turned left, they would turn right. Wherever he went, these guys were chasing him.
Mm-hmm.
He just couldn't get rid of these scavenger predators. Finally, he decided to just drop the fish. And all of them went to the fish, and he was free. And he had this enlightening experience that if you leave attachment, all the issues that come with it, all the hurt, all the pains of the world, you can let go. You're just holding on to it, and therefore we're in trouble.
Right.
So if the metaphor is there for us to see every day in so many incidences and so many interactions and so many natural circumstances, and we don't see the deep metaphor. And we are being told that in so many ways, but we are missing it in so many ways every day.
Well, this is exactly, you pointed to one of the great metaphorical stories, but this is exactly what we're doing. This is the whole rope snake story, the metaphor there. It isn't that there isn't something there. There is something there. We're just misunderstanding what we're seeing. We're overlaying time, space, and causation on Nirguna Brahman, and therefore misunderstanding what it is that we're actually experiencing. So it comes in all of these forms. But that story of the kite, it is. And somebody pronounced that fellow's name correctly.
I know, I'm
Advahuta?
Avadhuti is the name.
Say it again, please.
Avadhuta. Avadhuta. 24 kind of.
Right, yeah. Right.
Avadhuta,
right.
Nature. Yeah. You can get enlightenment with no guru, like you're saying, by being self taught.
This story has great parallels in the Native American tradition. Mm-hmm. That you learn from nature, you learn from the world around you, being always aware of the trickster who will deceive you about what it is that you're seeing.
If you talked about lighting this, the moon, if I may share a little fun incident, I have this habit of walking my dog with listening to Sarvabhyananda or Akhundupananda or whoever it is that is speaking about Vedantic truth, and it's always a rope and a snake story, right?
Right.
So I was walking my dog and I found in my distraction that he was very excited about something he was sniffing at. So when I saw it was a rope, I said, okay, it's just a rope and the snake story again. Guess what? It truly was a dead snake. And he was about to eat it, and if I had let go of thinking it's a rope, he would be eating a dead squirrel who was looking very stringy.
Oh, dead squirrel, my God.
It was looking very stringy, it was kind of in a circle. So it was truly, it was not a rape, and it was not an illusion, it was truly a...
Maybe past squirrel.
Yeah. What all of this points to is that we are creating the metaphors constantly for what we are seeing. We are deceiving ourselves, and we do it because we like it. We continue to do it because we like it.
We are party to this.
Yes.
And we want it that way.
Yeah. Well, until we don't. And then we find, oh my goodness, look what I've done to myself. Now I have all these mental impressions, that continue to haunt me. As I wrote, a tanka, this deep dive into the unfamiliar has me reeling. Ghosts arise. Shall I love them back to sleep or dance with them in the dark? You know, this is the thing. When we do spiritual practice, we discover, oh my God, all this time that I've spent, attaining human form and being a human being, so much baggage I have created. But then we have to, as you say, we have to be like the kite who discovers, oh, if I just let go of the fish, if I just drop it, then all of the troubles go and follow the fish. I can sit on the branch and say, oh, I'm liberated, I'm free. Very simple to say. Not so easy in practice. So I'm glad this lightened up. I'm glad we do. Yes, Dr. Mudge.
You know, this is because the brain sees those things which it is experienced to see.
Yes.
And therefore, whatever message, the five message senses are given, there is a circumscribed area in the brain. It can take the messages only from that sphere.
Mm-hmm.
For example, snake and rope, which keep on talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the same snake, when it winds down a branch of a tree, we cannot see it. Because our brain says, it has got to be like a piece of rope or snake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the way we create our illusion, because of our inability to see that the brain is a very limited power of experiencing things.
Mm-hmm.
But on the funny side, when Swami Yogeshwaranji went to California, and he came back, and he had to clean an ashram there. And he says that was a lot of work, and he says for the first time, while cleaning the ashram, he saw a snake there.
Ah.
I says, Swami, why? Are you sure it was a snake and not a rope?
And he said,
He laughed.
Yes. So, yes.
I'm like the guy who said, these Vedantic people have a snake problem.
Yeah. This is snake
everywhere. This is snake everywhere.
What create is snake.
But the word illusion starts with ILL. It's ill. It's a sick thing.
It's and a kind of sickness,
problem,
is it?
You say Maya, you can split Sanskrit in a number of ways, depending upon how you want to do it. Ma, ya, don't go there. Ma means don't, ya means go. Don't go there. But most of the time you say, oh, let me go there, I can come out of it.
Yes.
It's a quicksand, don't worry, I know how to get out of the quicksand.
Yeah.
And that's where we sink deeper and deeper.
Right.
There was one conversation where I was intrigued, and somebody said from the audience to Vivekananda that, okay, so this world is just a school where we have to learn to, you know, get commands, enlightenment. And he says, no, ma'am, this is just a circus and we're just clowns. So when you say that, it means the whole thing was purposeless and we're just supposed to take everything as a circus, or we're supposed to try to... I mean, there are two ways of looking at it, right? You work towards, seriously towards enlightening yourself, or you just throw the whole thing and say, it's all an illusion, let me just be in being. So, which is, the one is proactive, one is inactive. I wondered which one would be a better way to conduct yourself. Completely be dispassionate, or work furiously towards perfecting yourself.
It's your choice, dear. You have to come to the conclusion and make the priority choice yourself. There is no one that can tell you. Someone could tell you until they were blue in the face and you were completely exasperated. And if you didn't believe it, it would be a waste of time on both your parts. So the idea is, you assess the situation and you say to yourself quite honestly, This is what Sri Ramakrishna said. No difference between the thoughts, the lips, and the action. What do I truly believe? And one good formula for this is just sit down with a piece of paper and write these words. Without shame, without consideration of others, without calculation of consequences, what I really want is, and then fill in that blank. Keep doing that until you're satisfied with the answer. Write it over and over, without shame, without consideration of others, without calculation of consequences, what I really want is. What you'll find is, as you do this exercise, how much you are possessed by shame, how much you are possessed by consideration of others, how much you fool yourself by trying to calculate consequences when nothing is a greater fool's errand. After you've filled in that blank to your satisfaction, then you can look and say, is there anything shameful about it? How will it affect others, and how do I need to compromise if I need to compromise? And you can laugh at yourself for all of the times that you've tried to fill in that blank and you started calculating consequences. And you get to this idea, you know, I really am being a proper fool because I have not the slightest idea what's going to happen the next instant, let alone a week, a month, a year from now. Without shame, without consideration of others, without calculation of consequences, what I really want is. Keep doing that until you're happy with the answer. Then you'll know how to set your priorities and whether you believe there's any purpose or not. Is there any purpose in what you've written in what will make you happy? We just are so full of notions. And it isn't that we're bad. This comes with the territory. We got to be this human being sitting here this moment, if we buy the premise of reincarnation, we got here through many, 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 many different garments. We wore many different garments. And they all had their attributes, and they all had their experiences, and according to Swami Vivekananda, everyone left an indelible mental impression. And that conditions, that's what's part of our latent subconscious and our active subconscious, to use Jungian terms. And then those, of course, become part of our waking awareness. And we think, oh, I had that thought. Bull. That thought was created by the gunas playing across, which they're constantly doing, playing across the lake of your mental impressions and causing this wave and that wave on the lake of that. And so then you think, oh, I had that thought. No, that thought was produced by Maya, by the gunas, playing across your mental impressions, and the thought arose. And when you practice meditation, practice contemplation, concentration, and meditation for long enough, you begin to see the pattern of those things that are most near the surface of that lake of waking awareness, and are so easily stirred into waves of thought and feeling and perception. Meaningless. Meaningless. They are just something that arises, as the Buddhists say, and passes away. It arises and passes away. Arises. But if we get caught, if we try to hold on to that fish, we'll fly this way and fly that way, fly this way and fly that way, and find that the world is just following us. Ha 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 ha. Yes, over to the left. Is that Raj?
Yes. This illusion, Maya, things, it reminds me of the last closing prayer when we say, the gods may be peaceful. And when you say that word, that most average person who has not been exposed to kind of philosophy we are exposed here, why are you saying that? Gods may be peaceful. To me, it's like it's an illusion. If you consider the divinity itself is a perfect, then it shows the imperfection also at the same time, we know that. Mm-hmm. So for the interpreting the illusion, Maya, it's also depending on the how you, what's your experience and what level you have evolved yourself. And that's how the illusion works with you.
Yes.
If you, you do a lot of stuff in life, a lot of things comes to you, and a lot of people interact with you. But in interactions, you find some real, if nothing real, you still feel, and at the same time, you feel it's all real and all illusion.
Yes.
And so that's the reason the phrase we use, gods may be peaceful. So the gods, how come the gods are not peaceful, really?
Sometimes they're not. I mean, the story goes that sometimes they are very much not peaceful. But you know, that prayer is a prayer for what Swami Vivekananda says is the yearning of universe, is for the gunas to return to equilibrium, for there to be universal peace. For there would be, again, stillness on the face of the deep. No more manifestation. So, spiritual practice is an intensely entropic endeavor. It disassembles the complexity. Sri Ramakrishna says, God is simple. I don't yet know what's meant by that. I have a notion, but only that. God is simple. So we'll close with that prayer. Again, Swami Yogeshananda's translation of an ancient prayer. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace on the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout our being. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. And you know those last words, they're really very, very significant. To all beings everywhere. Time, space, and causation are an illusion. All the beings everywhere are at one point, Vivekananda says. So, may they be peaceful at that point. Om Hari Om Tat Sat.